And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. We go on to a book that's the stuff of nightmares. It's a book called Sons of Cain by Peter Vronsky, a definitive look at serial killers throughout history. Good morning, Peter Vronsky.
Good morning, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Why this book?
Well, because, you know, we're obsessed by serial killers, and certainly after my experience of having, you know, randomly run into one some 30 years ago, I myself have the same obsession. Where do they come from? How are they formed? You know, where are we headed in our world with this phenomenon? And so, you know, I try to just sum up everything I could find out about serial killers.
Tell me about your own experience, please.
Well, I was traveling in New York in 1979, long, you know, before the term serial killer had been coined in public discourse, and I bumped into a serial killer as he was fleeing the scene of double homicide with two heads in a bag. He had set the torsos on fire in his room, and as I was waiting for the elevator to go up, he came down, and we sort of collided in the doorway. I hadn't realized at the time what had occurred, so, you know, it was just like bumping into a normal guy on the elevator. You know, you're going to get off, you're going to come on. He passed me by, and then minutes later, the hotel was evacuated because of the fire, and I literally had to read the next day in the newspapers what it was that had occurred. So from that moment on, I was just left with this sense of wonder of, you know, this was like running into some kind of Alfred Hitchcock movie monster. So I was just left with the sense of wonder of where do these monsters come from?
Where do they come from?
Well, they come from us. They come from our families, from our society, from our civilization. They walk among us. They come out of trauma. They come out of terrible childhoods often. They come out of familial breakdown. They come out of dark, unhappy places.
Well, but what makes a serial killer a serial killer? I mean, let me detail the question a little bit. Man has financial trouble, kills his wife and two children, fresh out of the headlines. Is he a serial killer?
No. Here's, I think, why we're so interested in serial killers, because we all can imagine perhaps committing a murder out of jealousy, out of rage. It is not beyond our imaginations, you know, to lose control. Usually when that happens, when somebody commits a murder, they will regret it for the rest of their life. The difference with a serial killer is that they're going to do it over and over and over again, with these periods of what the FBI describes as the cooling off period, where they return back to their normal life and begin to contemplate killing again. So what it is, essentially, it's an addiction. And it's not so much an addiction to killing as it's an addiction to trying to act out this kind of homicidal fantasy they may have in reality. And failing to realize it in reality perfectly the way they had fantasized it, they're addicted to constantly improve on the fantasy. So thus you get that serial phenomenon where again, they kind of, after committing the crime, they feel something is still missing, and they begin to cycle up again.
Perhaps one of the most famous serial killers was Jack the Ripper, correct?
Jack the Ripper is probably the first serial killer we think of in our imaginations, yes. He's certainly not the first, however. We've had thousands of serial killers before Jack the Ripper. Jack the Ripper, of course, becomes famous because he's committing his crimes in the center of the English language newspaper world at that time, London. There's a huge newspaper war going on. So the stories are making headlines as newspapers are competing to report on this. This is 1888 in London. Of course, there is that salacious element that the victims are all prostitutes, and of course, he's mutilating them. He's leaving them, except for the last victim, out on the streets of London in Whitechapel. And, of course, he stays with us because we never solved who Jack the Ripper was. He's kind of like the Zodiac killer. We just don't know who he was. And so that gives him this kind of legendary status.
Lots of theories, though.
Lots of theories. Theories about perhaps he's an aristocrat, perhaps he's part of the royal family. Professionals, forensic profilers, for example, when they look at the Jack the Ripper killings, the most conclude that Jack the Ripper was very likely a local resident, that he would have been almost of the same class that his victims were. He was familiar with the neighborhood. He probably lived and worked in it. And very likely he would have been kind of in, a disturbed individual, but who might have, appeared to be innocuous overall. Something like the Green River killer, Gary Ridgway, who was a truck painter, an ordinary guy, nothing special about him.
Then, and I forget his name, there was the famous serial killer who stalked a Chicago World's Fair with his Hotel of Death.
Yes, well, that's you're thinking of H.H. Holmes.
Right.
Who currently is kind of being, presented as the first American serial killer, but he is certainly a serial killer in that we've confirmed that he's killed at least three people, but that's as best as, we've been able to determine how many victims he actually had. The whole story about the hotel is very likely mythology. Those secret rooms, really, he was involved in selling stolen furniture and other stolen property. So some of those rooms, the secrecy around them, involved that, his fencing operation. So all those claims that are made, some of them came from him. He was paid at a point to write a newspaper article, his so-called confessions. There's a lot of exaggeration around H.H. Holmes. But I found at least 20 years earlier several candidates for serial killings in the United States. Jesse Pomeroy, for example, in Boston, was a 14-year-old boy who killed two victims. And certainly by the FBI's current definition now, traditionally we define a serial killer as someone who's killed three or more victims. The FBI, since 2005, has amended that definition as far as they're concerned. It's now two victims or more in separate incidences. So Jesse Pomeroy, 1874, Boston, is one candidate. Joseph Lepage, the so-called French monster, a French-Canadian serial killer who killed two women in Vermont and New Hampshire, 1875. Thomas W. Piper, another Boston serial killer, around the same time, 1875, was attacking women in the street and killed a little girl inside a church in a belfry where he was a sexton. So there's a number of other candidates as America's first serial killer.
And it certainly wasn't limited to just America.
Oh, absolutely not. Serial killers appear in almost every society. It's just in the United States that we had this surge between 1970 and 1999, where of 82% of all American serial killers in the 20th century appeared in that 30-year period. You know, this is the what's you know, some people refer to as the golden age of serial killing. This is the era of the Ted Bundys, the John Wayne Gacys, the Jeffrey Dahmers. You know, when the term serial killer is finally coined in the public, you know, police have been using that term, but it first appears. I traced it back to the New York Times in the spring of 1981. So because this surge had occurred in the United States, because we had coined that term in those decades, we often thought for a long time that you know, this was a uniquely American phenomenon. It isn't. And you know, there are serial killers in China. There are surges of serial killers in South Africa in the 80s and 90s. So they appear everywhere in the world. Germany, France, Spain, Mexico, lots of serial killers out there.
Yet for all the horror, and certainly some of that horror, Dahmer and the others was well documented, It's also the stuff upon which entertainment has been built. I'm thinking of Alfred Hitchcock's movie Frenzy or the Broadway musical Sweeney Todd.
Sorry, I didn't quite hear your question.
Yes. With all the horror of serial killing, it's also the stuff that we've built entertainment on with things like Alfred Hitchcock's movie Frenzy or the Broadway musical Sweeney Todd.
Absolutely. You know, Alfred Hitchcock's movie Frenzy, I forgot his name at the moment, but there's a serial killer who was influenced and obsessed with that movie. He would play that scene over and over again because there's in Frenzy, there's this you know, very vivid scene where the serial killer kills this woman, and this other serial killer kind of took his cue off of that and built his fantasies around Frenzy. So certainly, you know, horror has always entertained us, and true crime has always entertained us. You know, before there were movies, there were true detective magazines, pulp magazines, and before those, in, you know, 18th, 19th century England, you had the so-called penny dreadfuls. These were, you know, penny broadsheets that would describe all sorts of horrible crimes that had occurred. So there's always a market for this kind of, quote, entertainment.
What do you think that says about us, though?
Well, it says about us that, you know, we sometimes, I think, read these stories kind of to seek reassurance that this is not happening to us. You know, in a way, these strange, horrible stories, I think, you know, almost comfort us in our own good luck. I don't imagine actual victims of crime are very big true crime connoisseurs or buyers of that literature after being exposed to something like that. So it's a kind of a, you know, as I say, I'm not a psychologist, but it's a kind of a reassuring thing that this is not me. This is not happening to me. And you know, people like to be scared. We know that, right? From roller coasters to horror movies, there's something about horror that draws us in. And I think serial killers, of course, are monsters of today. There are vampires and werewolves you know, things that go bump in the night. And what makes them particularly scary, of course, is these are not creatures that are coming from outside our world or from another planet. these are monsters living among us. It could be your neighbor. It could even be somebody you're married to. It could be your teacher, your fellow worker. It's monsters walking around us and targeting us. So I think that's the other draw of serial killers. But, in medieval eras, when people literally believed in werewolves, having written this book, my conclusion is that werewolves actually were human serial killers. They were lust killers who mutilated their victims, leaving them in a state that it looked like a werewolf had attacked them. And so when I looked at werewolf trials, there were a number of werewolf trials in the Renaissance era, roughly between 1450 and 1650. When I looked at some of the transcripts of those old trials, what they were accused of, it became clearly evident that they're accused of what we would today immediately recognize as ordinary serial homicides, the abduction and murder of children, attacks on women working in the field or traveling to town on the road. These were typical serial homicides, and except nobody could imagine that a human being was capable of these horrific crimes, and so they end up being charged as lycanthropes, as werewolves.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Peter Voronsky, author of the new book, Sons of Cain, A History of Serial Killers from the Stone Age to the Present. Lest people think serial killers are all men. There's the famous case of Aileen Wuornos.
Well, exactly. That's a big myth. Statistically, it could be that as many as one in every six serial killers is a female. Roughly, 16% in that percentile. Women are harder to recognize as serial killers. Because often, female serial killers kill, they're called the quiet killers because they don't leave bodies by the side of the road, for example, alerting, the community. We see cases of women often killing in places where it's logical for people to die. For example, nurses in hospitals, or home care workers, workers in retirement homes, and so forth. Women tend to kill for the same reason that male serial killers kill. The number one motive for a serial killer is control. They want control over their victim. They want control over their own selves. And the difference, of course, between the female and the male is that the female serial killer expresses her need for control in a different way than the male does. For males, it's often highly sexualized. Therefore, you have this kind of process of abducting a victim, rape, torture, mutilation, and so forth. For the female, it's more about the kill itself. Females, unless they pair with a male serial killer, and we have numerous cases of male-female serial killing teams, sometimes husband and wife, in those cases you sometimes see the female partner mirror kind of the sexual pathology of her husband. But when a female serial killer is operating alone, they very rarely torture their victim. They very rarely restrain, abduct their victim. They're, as I say, kind of quiet serial killers who have a longer career than the average male serial killer because they're so undetectable. Eileen Wuornos, of course, is the one serial killer, female serial killer, who breaks the mold. She's, of course, targeting males. She's a prostitute. She killed a number of individuals that she claimed were her clients. She used a handgun, which is also rare for a female serial killer. The number one weapon for female serial killers, of course, is poison. Again, this kind of surreptitious control over the victim. You know, the female serial killer doesn't need to be acknowledged that she has control in the way the male does. I think, you know, because of the male ego, that's why they go through that process of really exaggerating into a kind of deadly area their sense of control. For the female, it's much more subtle.
Then there was Philadelphia's own famous serial killer, Gary Heidnik.
Yes, if I'm not mistaken, in your part of town, this is a case I'm not as familiar with, but I understand this is an individual who kept women prisoner in his basement. He was apparently relatively wealthy, and you know, here's the other thing too. Often serial killers are not necessarily, when I think of this case, are not necessarily seeking to kill. They want something else. And sometimes to get that, they have to, as one serial killer described it, they have to evict the person from their body. In the case of Gary Heidnik, he had wanted to have slaves, and so what happens is, of course, as he abuses these slaves, they die on him. It wasn't that he was, you know, seeking to kill individuals. He just needed a slave, and he was going to get that slave one way or another. It's, you know, the same with Jeffrey Dahmer. Jeffrey Dahmer at first, you know, tried to possess his victims in a way that didn't necessitate killing them. So one of the things that Jeffrey Dahmer tried was injecting some of his victims with battery acid into their brain in the hope that he could turn them into eternal zombies that would be his constant sexual companion. And, of course, it failed. People, you know, his victims died on him. And you know, in the end, his possession, the way he arrived at that absolute possession, was cannibalism. He began eating some of his victims and you know, keeping them inside of him in this kind of ritual cannibalism.
And I'd like to say thank you to Peter Voronsky. His new book, Sons of Cain, A History of Serial Killers from the Stone Age to the Present. Thank you, Peter.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on, Peter.
My pleasure. And as it said in the old Scottish prayer, Lord protect us from ghosties and ghoulies and long-legged beasties and serial killers that go bump in the night. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. If you can't, nothing left to say, but see you soon. And we're back, and it's WIP Sunday. Our Sunday is with Earl Swift, author of Chesapeake Requiem, A Year of the Watermen, with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. Good morning, Earl Swift.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
I'm fine. Earl, where is Tangier Island anyway?
Tangier Island is smack in the middle of the widest part of the Chesapeake Bay. So if you picture the eastern United States having a bulging belly somewhat between Maine and Florida, of course, the Chesapeake is that long notch that's cut in the middle of it, about 200 miles north to south. And at its widest, it's about 30 miles wide. And Tangier's right there in the lower part of the bay, really where the waters from the Atlantic mix with with the outflow of the East's, the Mid-Atlantic's big rivers, the Susquehanna, the Potomac, and the James.
What led you to be interested in the island?
Well, it's a unique piece of topography on the American landscape. It's one of the few offshore islands in the East that's populated. And it's been a center for the seafood industry since shortly after the Revolutionary War. And if you live along anywhere near the Chesapeake in Maryland or Virginia or Delaware, you hear about Tangier eventually. It's one of those places that's been the subject of myth and misinformation and legend for generations. And I was a newspaper reporter in Norfolk in 1999, was sent there, took an assignment to go there and do a feature story on the place, and went back later that year to spend Y2K there. I spent the millennium on Tangier, which is a dry island, deeply religious, so it was a very quiet celebration. And then went back because I heard from residents during those two visits that the place faced an existential struggle. I went back in 2000 and spent 6 weeks on and off with a photographer, and that was really my first immersion into the place, those 6 weeks in 2000.
In fact, it was first mapped by John Smith, of all people, in 1608.
It was, yeah. He took a little tour of the Chesapeake in a shallop, and was nearly killed, actually, when he first laid eyes on Tangier. A storm blew up and nearly capsized the boat. But and you know, that visit and much of Tangier's history since has been there's been a lot of exaggeration. If you look at the state historical marker on Tangier, it'll tell you that John Smith stepped ashore and he named the place, and neither of those, certainly the first isn't proven and the second isn't true. He did map it. It was one of many blobs of land that he, which is how he represented islands in his first famous map of the Chesapeake Bay. But there is, he didn't actually set foot on the place, most likely.
And chances are, if you've ever eaten a soft-shell crab, you've eaten one of the products of Tangier Island.
Well, that's what it has been probably best known for since the very early 19th century. First for oysters, part of the craze in the 19th century that led oysters to become kind of an American dietary staple. So, you can thank the waters immediately around Tangier Island for that. And then really beginning in the late 19th, early 20th century, the oyster having been scraped barren pretty much from the floor of the Chesapeake, islanders and others around the bay turned their attention to the blue crab, and there is no other population on the bay that catches more as a community than Tangier does. And Tangier has in particular specialized in going after softshell crab, which I don't know if you ever had a chance to eat softshell at Old Bookbinders or any of the other Philly restaurants that serve it. It's a kind of a one of a kind menu choice that is just spectacular. You eat the crab legs and all, and Tangierman justly claimed to be the softshell crab. They claim the town to be the softshell crab capital of the world.
Now, it's obviously it's an island that's been settled and produces seafood. Is it an island that also has tourists?
It does. Over the last 30 years in particular, Tangier, because, as I mentioned earlier, it's this place of myth and legend, has attracted a growing number, mostly of day trippers. They come in on a tour boat that shows up at around lunchtime and leave again on the same boat that departs in mid-afternoon. So if you're on the island in the summer, you'll see the population double on some days between noon and 3 o'clock, say. But that tourist trade is not year-round. It lasts from May to to late September, early October. And for 7 months of the year, there's only one way by boat to and from the island, and that's the mail boat out of Crisfield, and Crisfield, Maryland, on the eastern shore. And it's it becomes a much more isolated, a lonesome place during those 7 months.
And I imagine everything from bread to milk to newspapers to fuel has to be boated in.
You got it. You bet. Everything comes in by boat, and a lot of it comes in on the mail boat. It's a 65-foot boat built to service offshore drilling rigs in Louisiana. That's actually what it is. And so it's a tough steel diesel-driven passenger boat that has a huge after deck on which, on most days, you'll see packages from UPS and FedEx and USPS piled high, along with groceries, because Tangier men have to make the occasional trip to the mainland to augment the kind of limited selection on the island's very small grocery store. Appliances, whatnot, everything comes in on that mailboat. If you need to move in something bigger, you have to rent a barge, which is how the fuel gets there. Big tanker barge. It's a logistical challenge to live on an island, even one that's just 100 miles from Washington, D.C., and it's part of what makes Tangier one of the most, if not the most, isolated community in the East.
Who lives on Tangier?
Tangier was first settled during the Revolution by a guy of Cornish descent, most likely named Joseph Crockett. And today, 460 of his descendants live there. Its population is down from a high point of about 1,300 in 1930 or so. But these 460 are a tough and hardy breed. And it's a fully functioning town with a town council and a mayor. And it's got a K-12 school. The only one left in Virginia, and all the amenities of an American small town, except that it happens to be on a squiggle of marsh and mud 12 miles from the nearest mainland port. And but the 460 people who live there, because they can all trace their lineage, or most of them can to one guy, are all cousins. I mean, this is one big extended family.
Mm. The weather, particularly in the winter, must be awesome.
Awesome is the actual, staying true to the actual definition of the term. It's brutal in the winter. It's essentially treeless. The high point on the island is 5 feet, but that's not indicative of the actual topography. Most of the island fails to clear 3 feet above the tides, and naturally in most of it is salt marsh, and it fails to clear one. 70% of the island is salt marsh. So the houses are arrayed on three extremely low, we're talking inches high, ridges of sandy loam that rise out of the marsh. And it's too wet to support trees for most of this dry ground, dry ground in quotes. So you've got nothing blocking you from a wind out of the northwest. Nothing at all. It comes just howling across the water and makes Tangier a miserable place on a stormy day in January or February. And likewise, because there are few trees, there's very little shade in the summer, and so the island broils under the sun. And if you're a crabber out in his boat pulling up crab pots all day, It's tough to come back to land and find no relief from that relentless oven-like heat. It just stays with you.
Why the heck, then, would anyone want to live on Tangier Island?
Well, I think tourists, a lot of tourists, after visiting the place, probably wonder the same thing. But it's for all of its physical challenges, it's a community unlike any in America, and it would not be that community were it not on such a tough piece of ground to live. And this is a place where when you walk out your door, you're greeted by name, by everybody you meet, everybody. And I found that it really kind of tested my notion of what is home. Because that certainly doesn't happen when I, you know, I leave the house and my, quote, home in central Virginia. I'm an anonymous character in a car, and nobody in the traffic around me has a clue who I am, and I don't know who they are. In Tangier, it's not like that. In Tangier, you are part of a greater whole. And I think that that is enormously appealing. And it is a, you know, I've painted a bleak picture of the landscape. It's a beautiful place. You do have to kind of recalibrate your senses somewhat to see the beauty, because it's a very quiet and nuanced beauty. But after a while, you get attuned to the play of the breeze and of light at different times of the day on the marsh grass and the music that grass makes when a breeze is sweeping over it. And it would be a tough beauty to capture in an oil painting, but it's there, and it kind of sneaks up on you. And you know, there is a certain wondrous beauty to living in the middle of nature. You're exposed out there. You're kind of part of a food chain almost, and vulnerable to the whims of nature from any point of whims of nature, rather from any point on the compass, and that gets appealing as well over time. It's difficult to explain, Peter, but it is a place that I find I'm always happy to be back, you know, arriving in, and I'm always sad to leave. And I hope I've explained it a little bit, but it's elusive, the reason that the place gets to you so.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Earl Swift. Earl is the author of a new book. It's part sociological study, part environmental, part natural history, and a whole lot more. The new book, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year of the Water with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. Now, Earl, I need you to stay with me. Got to run a few commercials. We'll be back. We'll be back in just a bit. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday. I'm with Earl Swift, author of Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. My name's Peter Solomon. All right, Earl, I would imagine two things from what you've described about Tangier Island so far. There's got to be a high birth rate.
Well, you know, if you go looking through Tangier's past, that's certainly the case. I mean, it was a very fertile place for generations, and we're in about the 10th generation now of Tangiermen, but that hasn't been the case since probably the mid 80s, the last 30 to 35 years. And the reason, Peter, is that young people there, like young people in southern and midwestern small towns and native villages in Bush, Alaska, are leaving. And with the advent of satellite TV in particular, I think, which arrived at about the time the trend started, you see young people deciding that the ways of their fathers and mothers, which is tough and uncertain and often dangerous, isn't the sexiest way to make a living. And they have left for college and the military in increasing numbers, to the point now that it's relatively rare to see a young person decide to stick. And so the birth rate has dropped like a stone, and the population has aged rapidly. The average age in Tangier now is in the mid-50s and growing by the year, increasing by the year. And there are a lot of islanders in their 80s and 90s.
How is health care on the island?
There is no doctor. The nearest emergency room is 30 minutes away by helicopter. There's a health center that's staffed by a very capable physician's assistant who's a native islander. And Inez Pruitt is her name. And her daughter, Anna Pruitt Parks, is the island's only paramedic. And so between the two of them, those ladies have people pretty well cared for, on an emergency basis. And then a doctor flies in every Thursday to spend the afternoon there and to see patients. These days, it used to be that a dentist came in as well. But if I'm not mistaken, these days, teen chairmen usually go ashore for that.
Or you have your teeth hurt.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me. I mean, the only thing I have to compare Tangier Island to is a visit I made once to Monhegan Island off of Maine. Same kind of windswept, only tourism for a few months, everything coming in by boat. In the winter, you could die and no one would know.
Yeah. I think that the exception might be that because everybody's family on Tangier, you would not die unobserved. I mean, you'd be missed immediately on Tangier. And when we were talking about why people live there a few minutes ago, I failed to mention the number one most pragmatic reason. That is, there is no better place in all the world to go harvest crabs than out in the middle of the bay on an island surrounded by seagrasses on the floor of the bay, which is where crabs take refuge. It really puts Tangier at an almost unfair advantage over any other place to do that. So if we lose Tangier, and I realize we have not yet gotten deep into that part of the story, but if we lose the island, we lose a primary source for a delicacy that we've all come to take for granted.
All right, let's dive into that question then. What's going on that we are in danger of losing the island?
Well, the island is surrounded by water, and that water is on the rise. And the rate at which it is rising is accelerating. It's accelerating at an alarming rate, a rate that was not foreseen just 10 years ago. And all of the predictions that science has made about what we face in terms of climate change and man influenced sea level rise has proven to be understated significantly. So there's that. Compounding that problem is the fact that the Mid-Atlantic and the lower Chesapeake in particular is sinking. It's sinking as a byproduct of the last ice age, and it's sinking at a rate almost as great as the water is rising. So you have a 1-2 punch facing an island that is barely above the water to begin with. And if you look at maps of Tangier from the 1850s, which is really the shifting point for land loss in the Chesapeake and sea level rise. That's really where you see the trend beginning, about right in the mid-19th century. Slow at first, very slow, but gradually building steam as we go into the 20th, and then getting increasingly worse throughout the 20th century. If you look at a map of the island from the pre-Civil War era, you see a much, much bigger place, three times the size of the current island. And since then, Tangier has lost land at the rate of about eight acres per year. Now, it was never a big place to begin with, and now it's a tiny place. It doesn't have 8 acres a year to give up, but it's given it up. And so the every year you see marsh turn to open water. You see the very little upland or dry, high and dry ground on Tangier start to be eaten away at its fringes to turn into marsh. The whole thing's getting soggier and lower, and it's slowly drowning. Well, not so slowly. It's drowning quickly. It's drowning almost before your eyes. So when I was there in 6 weeks in 2000, the situation was pretty perilous then. But and that was before people started using sea level rise, like they do now. At that point, all of Tangier's problems, at least by the folks in the bay, was ascribed to wind-driven erosion, just wave action. And it's clear that that's not what's going on. And it's also clear that while erosion certainly has taken its toll, erosion and sea level rise are not an either-or proposition. These are interlinked phenomena. And so what you have happening in Tangier by 2016, when I returned to live there for 14 months, had taken a dramatic toll. I could not believe that I was looking at the same island in places. It was that dramatic a difference in 16 years.
In fact, I'm told the island might be gone by 2063, if not sooner.
Yes, and that's gone. That's not abandoned. It'll have to be abandoned much, much sooner. But we're looking, the latest projections has the sea level in the lower bay rising by 2 feet by 2050, which is tomorrow. You know, I mean, it's just an almost incomprehensible rate of increase. And now that's relative sea level rise. So again, that's the 1-2 punch of water coming up and land in this particular region going down. It's the subsidence of the land is not nearly as pronounced in, say, in Philadelphia, although you're experiencing it there, as it is in the lower bay. And by the time you get as far south as, say, the Outer Banks, Cape Hatteras, it's not as pronounced there either. But you've got a region I'd say between Baltimore and just south of Norfolk, where this is a real issue.
Is this rising?
I'm sorry. No, it's just, 2050 is not only tomorrow for Tangier, but also for some of those, for Norfolk in particular. Norfolk faces some titanic challenges over the next 20 years. It's 25 years. There are already neighborhoods that flood with each high tide, and that's going to get worse.
I'm told that the crop of female crabs is dropping fast, roughly 70% in just 6 years. Is that a product of this rising water or something else going on?
Well, that is that was the case in the late 90s. From 1994 to 2000, the number of female crabs did nose downward to the point where there was actual talk that the species was in danger, that that a combination of overfishing and poor water quality in the Chesapeake had conspired to doom the Chesapeake Bay blue crab to extinction. And it prompted the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, to institute a number of what watermen consider draconian measures to try to shore up the health of the species. And for the most part, they worked. And although there are down years in the crab population, in the last few years, it's looked much more encouraging. This has been a pretty good year for crabbers. Last year was a pretty good year. The year before that was a very good year. So we've had three pretty solid years in a row, and probably goes beyond that as well. Then again, there are years when the number of female crabs, the number of young crabs, which of course is a function of how many females you have, is inexplicably low. And there are years where scientists are just plain stumped as to why that is. All the indicators can be that the crab is going to enjoy a bumper year, and the numbers will be inexplicably down. And the watermen will explain that it's mostly because scientists don't know that the water's wet. They have a very low view of science in general, and they'll also explain that the blue crab is beyond understanding. That I had one crabber tell me, all that's known for sure about her is that she'll run from you and she'll bite. And the more you get to know about the creature, the truer that actually seems to be.
It's kind of frightening to think that's happening.
It's incredibly frightening. And the rate at which it's happening is particularly alarming, Peter, because I'll live to see it. And my daughter certainly will live to see it. And you try not to be pessimistic about such things. But if this, we're talking millions and millions of people that not just the 460 on Little Tangier, but millions of people, tens of millions of people who are going to be directly affected by this. And, of course, all of us will be indirectly affected. And here's our canary in the coal mine. Here's the first town that's going to go. And, you know, if you're on Tangier, that distinction is not a comfortable one to wear. But we have to decide pretty quickly how we're going to deal with this issue, because it's not going to wait for us. We have to get busy deciding how we decide which towns, which communities we save or try to save, and which we simply surrender to the sea, because we will not have the time, the money, or the technical means to save every place. And so how we deal with Tangier and its issue will inform how we address this problem time and time and time again in the very few years to come.
Do we have the technical means to save Tangier Island?
Yeah, we do. It would require truly heroic intervention, and by that I mean maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. You could build a riprap seawall around the whole place. You could pump in dredge spoils and lift up the lay of the land by a few feet. You could buy it. You could buy it a century or more. So it's technically feasible. Whether it's economically feasible is a question that public policy people will have to decide. Because again, this, you know, what we do there does inform what we do later. So if it turns out that headcount, for instance, is the main criterion by which we decide whether to save a place, it won't make much sense to try to save 460, you know, the properties of 460 people living on Tangier. If, on the other hand, we recognize that just relying on headcount would doom a lot of what we Americans consider sacred ground, basically, small places that are important to us despite their small populations, then Tangier is a viable candidate. So it depends. Well, whether we undertake such a project really depends on how we decide how to decide what's saved.
And when we come back after some more messages, I'm going to ask my guest, Earl Swift, about the political scene on Tangier Island. I'm told it's a hotbed of Donald Trump supporters. And I'm going to ask him why and what they hope President Trump will do for them when we come back in just a bit. The WIP time, 7:36. And we're back and into the home stretch here on WIP Sunday with Earl Swift, author of Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island. My name's Peter Solomon. Okay, Earl, the politics of Tangier Island, a hotbed of Republicans?
Well, not necessarily Republicans. It's a difficult place to characterize. Now, I may have buried the lead somewhat, Peter, because this is a place that's so isolated that it has its own style of speech, its own dialect, which if you were to listen to a couple of natives talking to each other, you would be hard-pressed to decipher, even word by word. It's a place that values self-reliance to a great degree. As you might imagine, the Tangiermen see themselves as basically cowboys on the water. So I think they find appealing a politics that emphasizes that self-reliant spirit. At the same time, they have been dealing with a federal government that has mired them in red tape on every project designed to ease their dilemma with the rising water. And so I think in 2016, they found themselves favoring Donald Trump, both because he seemed to be espousing kind of a take care of yourself agenda, and also because he was somebody, because he claimed to have a record in business, that they thought would be able to cut through the government red tape and get them some help. So it was this oddly kind of contradictory appeal that he had to them, I think. And they voted for him overwhelmingly, almost 88% of them, 221 of the 253 votes cast in November 2016 were for Trump. And there's another issue layered on top of it as well, and that is that partly as product of its isolation and its people's helplessness, I guess, in the face of all the natural challenges that they face day to day in terms of weather and waves and whatnot. Tangier is a very religious place, a deeply religious place, and it's an old school brand of religion. It's almost a Victorian era kind of shouting Methodism, and that certainly played a factor in the vote as well. Because from the pulpit, you know, Donald Trump was clearly pushed in both of Tangier's churches.
Okay, basically, Tangier Island is a Christian place.
It's very close to a working theocracy, and which is not to say that it's not without its foibles. It's got plenty, but it's a place that in which no municipal decision is made that, you know, in defiance of the church, certainly the church is. There's a Methodist church, the congregation of which dates back to 1807, and there's kind of a renegade literalist, biblically literalist splinter from that Methodist congregation that's also alive and well. So on any Sunday, about half the population is going to be in church. Mm. And as you know, watermen will tell you, you don't work on the water long before becoming. And you can't work on the water long and not believe in God. And it's kind of a no atheist in the foxhole sort of view because you spend a lot of time on the Chesapeake in one of these shallow draft little boats, and you will before long experience weather that will inspire real fear. And the Chesapeake, when it gets riled, doesn't have the sort of great oceanic swells that you see out in the Atlantic. It builds a corduroy chop of high frequency waves that will not so much rock your boat as just beat it to pieces. And it can be scary. If you're out there in 35 knot wind, you're having a hard time keeping your feet on a deck that is, you know, rolling around like a bad carnival ride. And so, yeah, they're religious.
How about, though, its representation at lower levels, state and Congress?
Well, I think that they tend to favor Republican candidates, at least in recent years. Now, Virginia is finding itself increasingly blue, and perhaps that will someday be the case in Tangier too. But you know, this is a state where Democrat used to not mean what we think of Democrat meaning. You know, I mean, it was to be a Southern Democrat back in the day was to be what you'd call a Republican now, and so it's you know, the labels have shifted somewhat in recent years, and we're just now getting to the point where Virginia sees the labels the same way the rest of the country does, and is responding accordingly. And while throughout pretty much at every level of government, the state is gradually becoming bluer. Tangier is part of a great rural sea of red that remains.
Okay, how has Donald Trump responded? Has the federal government responded to Tangier's plea?
Well, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers is the agency that that has direct responsibility for projects such as that, which would possibly save Tangier. And the Army Corps of Engineers has, in the past, worked with Tangier to build some, you know, flood control devices, basically a revetment, a riprap seawall on the western edge of the island that it put up in 1989. It took about 15 years to get that built. And since shortly after it was built, for the last 26 years, in other words, the Corps has been talking about building a very simple jetty that would help protect the harbor from damaging winds from the west. It has promised numerous times to get that built within the next year, and numerous times has failed to deliver. So to put a whole lot of faith in this concept that Tangier could be ringed by a seawall and raised with dredge spoils, which is a concept that the Corps itself unveiled to Tangier back in 2016, is to really it borders on wishful thinking. This is a project that would take years to complete if it were ever undertaken. And, you know, it's debatable as to whether there would be anyone left on Tangier to celebrate if it were completed. But anyway, not long after the election, in June 2017, CNN came to Tangier, and led by meteorologist Jennifer Gray. And she met with a bunch of old-timers who have a daily coffee clatch in one of Tangier's abandoned buildings. And she got to talking to Tangier's Mayor Uker Eskridge, James Uker Eskridge, and he happened to mention to her that he loved Donald Trump as much as any member of his family. And that quote created a sensation around the world and prompted President Trump to call Uker 3 days later. And what he said to Uker was viewed as a promise of help by the president. He said that he loved Tangier, and he, as far as he was concerned, Tangier had been there for hundreds of years and would be there for hundreds more. But that was not clearly a promise to help. It was an idle remark, and nothing's happened since.
Well, but when Tangier Island is in competition with other federal projects like Southern Walls, Donald Trump's facing some difficult decisions.
Yeah, and again, we're talking about a town of 460, and you know what it has going for it is that there is no other place like Tangier. It is, and unique is a word that's overused, but this truly is a unique piece of the American landscape. There just aren't that many places that have developed their own language. these are people of English stock who, again, if you were to hear them talking to each other, good luck trying to figure out what they're saying. In addition to an accent that is tortured, to say the least, they have a habit of saying the opposite of what they mean. So even if you do make out the words, the meaning can escape you.
What's the next book, Girl Swift?
Well, golly, Peter, I just finished this one. Give me a break here. I mean, this is 120,000 words. That's a lot of words.
Now, there's an old saying, though, you know, dancers dance and reporters write.
Yeah, well, it's true. I've got a few prospects. I'm concentrating on spending 2018 not writing a book. It's the first year in 12 that I've not been actively working on a book project. So I've been doing magazine work, writing quite a bit for Outside. And in fact, I wrote a story that appeared in the June issue about Tangier, about an incident that occurred on Tangier that really kind of underlined gets back to that question of why do people live there? And that is that a father-son crabbing team went down in a storm in April 2017. And this storm was just a crazy confluence of wind and waves. And it took this very seasoned captain and his boat down. And every able-bodied man on Tangier jumped into a little boat and raced out into the teeth of that storm trying to save him. And so part of what getting back to, you know, why people live there, this is a place where people would literally die for each other. This is a place that redefines community to what, in a way that most of us can't grasp. Community means something on Tangier. the story was a tragic one that appeared in Outside, but it but the silver lining was that the entire town responded to this crisis, and you just don't see that happening everywhere.
Well, given that, though, Earl Swift, would you be willing to pack up your computer and move to Tangier and right there?
Well, contrary to popular belief, Peter, I don't need a quiet room. You know, I don't need a clean, well-lighted place. This is how I make my living, so I have to do it wherever I am. I have to just sit my butt down and start typing. And but yes, of course, sure. I came to love Tangier. I spent 14 months there, and I was sorry to leave. I was just back last weekend, and I pined for the place all the more. And part of that is this severe but strangely beautiful landscape that it has. But, of course, the biggest piece of it is the people, the Tangiermen. Because it's a community and because it enfolds you when you're accepted on the island, to a degree that was new to me. And I've lived all over the world, and I found Tangier to be a unique in its in the loving, generous, and very humor-filled spirit of the people. And that's a long answer to a short question. But yes, I could live in Tangier. I could. The problem is that unless something dramatic happens, you're just borrowing your time there, because it's, unless heroic intervention happens, it's gone. It's leaving the place, leaving the scene pretty quickly.
Well, Chesapeake Requiem, A Year with the Watermen of Vanishing Tangier Island, is a multi-layered story. It's a story of a community and a community that builds family. It's a story of an island. It's a story of climate change. It's a cautionary tale as well, because not only is Tangier an island, the island in danger of being a victim of climate change, but as Earl Swift pointed out, places like Norfolk, Virginia are not far behind. Thank you, Earl Swift.
Peter, thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. And you've been listening to WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sunny Hill. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. Your action, always wanted. Sunny's always got something good to say. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Ann Tideman-Solomon, the associate producer. Couldn't do the show without you. Nothing left to say, but stay cool, stay dry. See you soon.